It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Jules Gill, I saw your lovely face in person. Now we're back on the old Zoom, but it's still just as lovely. How's he doing?
It's very weird not to touch your face. Obviously, like yesterday, we were just rubbing all over each other, just getting all the juices flowing.
All the pokes,
but now we've taken all of that distilled juice, we've turned it into a fine sort of like amazing alcohol, and we're about to sup it today as we answer some of the finest questions from around the internet. Because it is time for the UBP.
The UBP, the Untitled Banter Chalice, as you must take a few sips, where we ask people for whatever they'd like us to talk about, various questions, various talking points across the industry. The first one is from Brandon Bressman, who says, how good will a movie version of Streets of Rage be by the John Wick creator? That's a hell of a shout. I think if you get Chad Stahelski in, just point him at any sort of martial arts based thing.
Yeah,
if you could do fire punches and flying kicks and whatever, I would massively take that.
It's a weird one, isn't it? Because like when you play through Streets of Rage, especially the newest Streets of Rage 4, you realize how like ludicrously simple those games are when it comes to plot. It's literally just like there is a bad guy, there's some corrupt police officers, go there, beat them up. Like it's fantastically simple. But as it was shown with the likes of The Raid and with Judge Dredd, obviously Dredd's 2013, I can't remember when it was that came
movie.
Out.
Yeah,
like it's a simple premise of there is a bad guy at the top of the floor, get up there, and Hardcore Henry and stuff like that have a very simple like flow. Mm-hmm. I feel like it could work really well if it was delivered, if the action was like front and center of it. And also, if you had the sort of late game twist where the two people that were teaming up or the team of three that we see, if one of them turns on them when is offered a chance by Mr. X to join their ranks and take over the city with them, that would make for a brilliant late game twist.
Plus, I mean,
like awesome fight scenes.
It's like a weird thing, but I mean, you think about like, you know, group fight scenes or one-on-one fight scenes. Like, I can't think of two, like you do get a hybrid in the likes of the John Wick movies, but that would be a good way for two main action stars to finally go off against each other and it becomes a versus movie in like the closing few minutes or something.
Because it's like, The Expendables was like the basic premise was like loads and loads of action scenes all like stapled together. And to be honest, like it worked. I wouldn't say that they're my favorite films, but there's like a definite approach to that sort of style of just more equals more that could work for a Streets of Rage film. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'd be very interested to see that.
Did you ever see the Dynasty Warriors movie? Have you seen clips of that thing?
Right. Okay. So you would have thought that I would have seen that straight out of the gate. But as soon as it came out, I just got hit with a ton of like conflicting opinions on it of like, oh, don't watch this, waste of time. Or like people are saying it's so stupid, it's worth watching. But then I was like, you know what? I probably would have 100% better time just playing the Dynasty Warriors games. Like 100%. And I've seen that story told nearly, well, since 2000, whenever the second Dynasty Warriors came out, I've seen the same story told again and again, the romance of the Three Kingdoms. So I was a bit like, I probably don't need to see this movie.
I was just thinking, but like,
everything.
In terms of like, there's Dynasty Warriors, and I think the Ace Attorney movie both have, like, obviously they're live action, but they're accentuated by CG, like, especially in Dynasty Warriors, like really impactful punches and stuff. And I was like, that's how I would do a Streets of Rage movie. If you did John Wick choreography, but every like massive blow is like, like emphasized by a fire punch and the person goes flying across the room. Like, that would be sick. I know we've just talked about 10 minutes for Streets of Rage, but it sounds good.
But the best sort of video game fight sequences at the moment are from the Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
That's a perfect shout.
Yeah. It's like they incorporate it into real life things, and none of them are like sort of graceful. There's not any sort of like over the top choreography apart from like maybe one or two fights, and all of the hits feel impactful because it's like the slightly digitized skin when they get hit, or like the shockwave of the impact when they fall down. Like, it's. There's ways to make those things feel really connected to the video game source material and be gamey, like at the same time.
If you did that and you had like really like a literal visual punch and it was like more identifiable in that regard, like a signature thing, and you had the Streets of Rage music, like that would be. I know there's no. I know this isn't happening, but like a Streets
of Rage, it would be very good.
Movie in this regard would be brilliant. Overall, next question down. We got a few questions in regards to the PlayStation Plus Premium thing that broke a couple of days ago.
Okay.
Which is the idea that Sony are mandating 2-hour free trials. Two-hour trials if you pay for the PlayStation Plus Premium tier, which is the top tier version of the new PlayStation Plus service, which means that any game priced $34 or above has to offer its first 2 hours as part of the premium package. Yeah. And so a lot of people asking about this stuff, just sort of seeing how much will it impact potential indie devs, how much, you know, what are your general thoughts on it? So let's just break that stuff down. And what were your thoughts on that? And then I'll do mine.
So I personally don't like this feature. I don't like that you're holding demos as an exclusive feature for your top tier paying things. This should be included as a mandatory thing across all sort of subscription levels, because why is it fair for somebody who is not paying a couple of quid more each month to not receive the same quality of life and care that you would have for a video game that's just coming out? Mm. If, for example, I was on the top tier, you were on the middle tier, and I was like playing for 2 hours, unfortunately, Scott, you've just found out that it's a bad game.
Yes.
So you've sunk in your £70 into that game now, whatever it's going to be, or the like per month thing. But I, on the other hand, I'm not going to experience that, and I can get the refund straight away. Mm-hmm. It's like,
well, I guess you wouldn't buy in, because like you'd be able to check it out for those 2 hours. The thing that's interesting is that all that information is going to get out there anyway. Like something like a Battlefield 2042, or any game that is, you know, nigh on broken, buggy, disappointing, not living up to its expectations, whatever. That stuff is immediately going to get out there, because anything with a premium price tag is going to be accessible for 2 hours. So I like that side of it. I like the fact that, you know, you have the Ubisofts, the Warner Brothers, the EAs, the whoever's, they can't quote unquote get away with this anymore, because you can't just go, here's a big marketing campaign, here's your launch date, and then they just sit back for a bit and patch it later. We'll all know immediately en masse, or however how big the premium tier gets, how broken these games are. I do agree though that the there should be at least some version of the trial available to everybody. I think that's interesting. There's also that thing, I saw people talking about the distinction between, or I want more people to talk about the distinction between demos and trials, because I saw people saying that, you know, it's bad on the devs because you're forcing them to slice off a part of the game and make it a demo. But that's not true.
No, that's not the truth. You get the game for 2 hours and it's your opinion at the end of it if you want to.
It's kind of what the Resident Evil 2 remake did, where you sort of just get access, or what Square Enix are doing now. The one good thing Square Enix are doing is that you can play Triangle Strategy and Stranger of Paradise and whatever. You can play those games for chunks of time. I mean, I got about 6 hours out of Triangle Strategy before I paid for the full game. And then migrate your save over. But that's a trial. That's a trial of the finished game, which is different to slicing off a vertical slice of the game during development to be a demo. So I think, but that's the thing. Sony have said that demos in the real sense are an option. If you don't want to do the trial, you can create a demo. So I quite like them holding the feet to the fire of the bigger teams. And I think $34 is an interesting split. Obviously, that's half of their premium 70 that they go for.
Yeah.
And it's like, I mean, obviously, I saw people obviously talking about indie devs, but hardly any indie dev is charging more than $34 for their game. Like, they can easily make a 2-hour story or a half an hour story or whatever it is, and charge an amount of money that is applicable. So I mostly quite like it, although I do agree with you that you shouldn't just mandate the trials entirely.
I feel like I maybe came across as a bit too harsh in the sense of like, I don't like it. I don't like the principle of sectioning off it to top tier paying subscription models, but I do agree with it as a principle overall, because I think that people should be able to have the most transparent relationship they can between themselves and the video game that they are playing. Mm-hmm. So a 2-hour window on any video game is always a good thing, because that is a reasonable amount of time to make up your mind as to whether or not you like what this game has to offer. It will allow you to try out single player modes, multiplayer modes, see what it is. And it does, like you say, hold developers to task to make sure that their games launch in a fit state. Mm-hmm. And the amount of times that we have seen games come out now with like huge day one patches, incredible like long development times of like getting the rollout all bug fixes and stuff
like
that.
Battlefield launched, just got a scoreboard now.
Yeah.
They
launch in just like absolutely abysmal states. And I hope that this will have the wider reaching impact of making sure that developers are actually given goals to hit that are much more reasonable rather than just, right, we're going to have to release 65% of the game and we'll just plug the rest of it in. Like that worth 70 quid at all.
No, and the thing that's coming out at the minute, which is also breaking, I saw on Twitter this morning, Yuji Naka, a Sonic creator who made Balan Wonderworld, he actually left that project a year and a half ago, but wasn't able to tell anyone. And now he's suing Square Enix because obviously that game was trash. My name's getting dragged through the muck because of this. So I hope that in this regard, like it gives developers more power to have those meetings and those conversations with their publishers and the marketing teams, whatever, and just go, look, we need those first 2 hours to be very strong. And obviously there's the side of it where the publishers go, well, polish the first 2 hours and the rest of it will patch later.
There's ways to get around this already. Like, for example, if you're releasing a huge like online FPS game, then you won't have the multiplayer live on the day of launch because you'll have that 2 hour window just to be the single player or maybe some like other modes that are on there. Because at that point, then you go like, well, there's not anything technically wrong with this. And now we can release the buggy mess of the multiplayer mode down the line sort of thing. Or you'll just get a completely anemic version where there's not even two hours worth of content to begin with.
Well, that's the thing. I think overall, and also the thing that's really interesting is that it's a hell of a way for Sony to immediately compete with Game Pass. Because if they make it so that everything over $34, like as a baseline rule, has to have a 2 hour trial, then you've arguably got a Game Pass equivalent because everything that would be on Game Pass would be for sale on the PlayStation Marketplace. And unless it's retailing for less than $34, then you can dive in as well. And so like it's almost a Game Pass equivalent in that regard in terms of an archive of content. I've not actually ever looked, I don't think Xbox released that much data on completion rates of the Game Pass games, but I would imagine that 2 hours is an overall median amount of time for the average person to dip into a selection of Game Pass games before they settle on something. Because I guess in terms of like a value proposition, you know, if you're already paying for Game Pass, if you're already thinking that's a reason to invest in Xbox, then this is their way of saying stick with PlayStation or come along to PlayStation. And whatever's over there will have our version of it. Although it is in the most expensive tier. Like it is going to be, well, in terms of dollars, it's $17.99 for premium, £13.49. And so it is more expensive at the minute anyway. But in theory, you get all the PS1, PS2, whatever stuff, which I saw Mr. Driller is going to be on there. So if you need a reason to drop all this money.
Fantastic.
So we'll see how that stuff pans out. But I'm curious what happens towards the end of May, because that's when the PlayStation Plus stuff launches in Asia. So we should, like, that has to be a version of the service. And I guess we'll finally get an idea of it. I just thought it was weird that the amount of devs being asked to whether they support this trial thing is happening like a month before it launches in one of the major territories. Like it feels like Sony are very last minute with this stuff.
I wonder if they actually did know in advance, but they're just making it public now. Like, but imagine being a developer at this point, just being like, oh, right, okay, fair enough, we're doing this. But then again, the argument should be, well, you shouldn't have to be surprised that somebody's asking for your game to be working upon release. You shouldn't be like, oh, Christ, guys, we better get working really hard now.
I think it is interesting because you think about, like, you know, like, obviously, when patches could be a thing in gaming, it changed the landscape entirely. And you obviously got people taking advantage of that, releasing broken games and patching them later. And it's like, what would it take to get back to the launch day version of the game is the pristine thing, like, or as close as possible. Even Elden Rings had sizable or notable patches that changed the map system and stuff like that. But how do you get as close to that as possible? And I like this as a step in that direction, even if it's maybe impossible given the overall size of most games, especially over the 34 price tag mark.
Because I'm not entirely sure if they still charge the developers for each patch that they roll out. I'm not sure if that is a thing.
I don't think that's a thing anymore.
I remember it was a thing. And that was when you had people doing select patches. They would wait for huge things and then just do like massive patches to make sure that they didn't have to pay to do it again. And to be honest, that was a pretty good time for gaming because it was like, yes, we'd have our issues fixed within the game, but we wouldn't have to wait so long for them because they were like, right, this hot fix needs to come out right now. We're paying for it, so it needs to work, sort of thing.
Yeah, that's an interesting side of it as well, like, in terms of like, what qualifies this first couple of hours pristine version of the game. I think all of it, so there's a million variables and nuances to it that'll happen over time, and I fully expect someone like an EA or whoever to only make the first 2 hours good.
Something as well that I just thought, what if there's a sneaky way, right, of them doing day one patches, but you have to log into the game first, so it tracks that as counting down your hours. So you've got your 2 hour window, but you're spending an hour and a half of them downloading a day one patch.
God, maybe. And that's a whole thing, is we have no idea how the UI works for this stuff. Because obviously you have some sort of UI that lets you access all these games across all these generations. And then also, is tracking paying you on a time basis for the brand new games to make sure that you're not taking advantage of that stuff. Maybe they'll pull it off, but I guess we'll see how it goes. Next question from McAllister NYC, who says, just rewatched Indie Game the Movie, thanks Jules, and played Sable, thanks Scott. The following indie games have won at the Game Awards since 2014, but do you have a favorite? Shovel Knight, Rocket League, Inside, Cuphead, Celeste, Disco Elysium, Hades, or Kena Bridge of Spirits?
To be honest, like, there's the only one that sticks out for me in the my heart of hearts is Disco Elysium, man. Like,
really? I know
we spoke about it last week, and I honestly think that it might well be my favorite game. Like, at the moment, I won't. It's almost verging on the of all time status at the moment of how much I adore it. But BioShock has still got that firmly locked overall, down.
For me, Shovel Knight's the one that I've played the most of because I've played every single expansion and everything. I love that little character, and I was going to get a tattoo at one point, but I pulled myself back. But I think, like you said, Heart of Hearts, it might be Celeste, because Celeste just literally the themes of that game, its dissection of depression, anxiety, like understanding what someone's going through when they are living with those conditions fundamentally helped me with my own dad. So I was just like, that is, it massively helped me. And it totally went a more subjective thing. But if we're talking about favorites, it's got to be Celeste, even though all these games are brilliant. And
they're all fantastic.
Kena Bridge of Spirits has to be the most overlooked exclusive on PlayStation, to the point where I didn't even put it in my recent list that me and Josh did. But I love Kena Bridge of Spirits. Hades, obviously Shovel Knight, and it's a good time. Cuphead feels like it's dropped off. Like, it feels like that was such a big thing. And now the show's out on Netflix, but people don't really seem to care.
I guess it's because of the fact that they did the thing of it left the pot to cool too long, because there was Cuphead fever all around. Everyone was talking about it. It's like the 2D Dark Souls of gaming at the time. And obviously the very protracted release of the DLC, The Last Course, is like, it feels like we are way too late for a game. It should have come out within the first year or two. Mm. But now we're kind of approaching this thing where it's like, oh, I don't even remember how to play it. I'm gonna have to go and load back the game up again, go through it again just to familiarize myself with it all again. Like, I can't wait for it to come out. Don't get me wrong. Like, when it comes out, I will be playing through, and hopefully we'll get hold of Rich, who's obviously doing stuff with Traxian now, because we played through the entire game on stream back when we used to do streaming on gaming. Mm-hmm. So I will hopefully do a stream of that and like Live and Let's Dice and stuff.
The Herculean task that was you guys doing that. I think you did all of it like one sitting or something on one of the hardest difficulties.
Two sittings. Right.
I never finished Cuphead. I got to the final act, I think, or the final aisle, and there's like two bosses left. I'm fighting some mouse in a tin can, and I was like, I just can't do this anymore. So I had to give up. But someday I would like to do it, because I've done most of the hardest bosses. But I might go back to that eventually.
Yeah.
Next question from Gaming with Greg. What is your most treasured / valuable retro game in your collection, and why?
Oh man, I mean, it's clearly the copy of The Italian Job on the PlayStation. Oh. No, I was looking through my collection of PS1 games the other day, because they're all up in the attic at the moment, because I've got nowhere down in this room that I'm recording in to have it. And I haven't actually fired up the my PS1, 2 and 3 machine, which is the old Breadbox PX3 machine that had backwards compatibility. Mm-hmm. I do have some surprisingly rare games in there. Mm-hmm. I've got Sheepdog and Wolf, because I know we've been talking about that a long time. I've got,
I can't wait to get on my Steam Deck.
I've got the original first pressing of the Metal Gear Solid, which is very nice. I've also got the VR Missions one as well. I've got all of the Resident Evil games, the original Black Label ones. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of like what other crazy ones that I've got in there that are worth a surprising amount. Oh, I've got Marvel versus Capcom on the PlayStation 1.
Oh, like where it all began.
Oh, and actually, it might be X-Men versus Capcom.
What was the 3D X-Men game where it was like, oh my God, Mutant Academy on PS1?
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
That game was great. I remember renting that and just being blown away by it. For mine, three words, Jedi Power Battles. I just have a random copy of that. The thing is, I don't have a PS1 anymore, so I have nowhere to play it, but I do have games on my shelf that I just like picked out. I have ECW Hardcore Revolution, Jedi Power Battles. I have an old copy of the original Sonic on Mega Drive that just sits in its case and everything. Also have Metal Gear Solid, like you said, but mine's that Platinum re-release that they did. So I got that because my original one, I lent it to a friend. You know, you would lend games to a friend and they'd come back less than pristine.
Yeah, I know,
and
right?
You're like, I know you did something because it wasn't like this one I gave you.
So why are there so many scratches on it? Oh, I don't know, mate.
Something happened with it. And I was like, something did happen with it. You did. And it's not the same anymore. I remember getting Metal Gear Solid 2 back from my friend Steve, and it had three big scratches down the front of it. And I was like, well, what was that? And he was, I don't know. And I was like, what was this, the dog, was it? Like, just what was that? Steve.
Ridiculous.
Mental.
But I remember as well that just thinking about it, I've got Final Fantasy VI on the PlayStation 1, and I've got Final Fantasy Origins when they re-released that again.
Oh, which, shit, okay.
Which I think that they were... Okay. I think that they are different games.
Oh yeah, Origins is the re-release of like the first three.
Yeah, I can't remember what
it's been a long time. I think it's one of them.
But I've got them there up in the attic. But I think that my most treasured of all of them is probably going to be finally getting. I got a copy of Silent Hill 2 from my. From my friend Gareth, and it was the like limited edition one where it had all of like the crazy the cardboard sleeve,
nice.
And it had the like
I know what you mean.
Weird like sort of like watery effect on top of the disc. I remember coming home one day when I was living in Bristol, and the dog that we had in the house at the time came upstairs, and I just saw like bits of the disc on there, and I was like, "Are you kidding? Out of all of the things, you've chosen to chew that one up." And the dog's just like, "Yeah, sorry,
yeah, I'm a dog. I done dogged." Yep. I think I didn't even like think of this in this way because my N64 is new because I got it for my 30th. But it would be those games. Like I for a time I was priding myself on finding pristine versions of N64 games.
Yeah.
Until I realized that pristine boxed copies are like 60, 70
they're
pounds,
ridiculous amounts.
Plus, yeah,
so expensive.
But I did. I forked out for a fancy version of Mario 64. Even then, it's not pristine, but it's nice. And I've got a nice gold knife, got Perfect Dark. And so like, there are those, you know, there are like the big hits, but I also have like Mission Impossible that my wife got me, which is kind of,
it's not a good game. It is not a good game.
I have fun with it, but it's like an original Hitman. It's like open-ended levels, figuring out what you're supposed to do.
But yeah, also full of jank.
Controls like hell. Yeah. You're like, whatever that dude's called, Ethan is like a stick man. Yeah. But so I guess my entire N64 collection, even though it is very old school. Next question from Vin and Punk Bass, who says, thanks for all the great content. Other than graphics, frame rate, etc., what innovations do you think might come from the next console generation, if any? Also, favorite beers.
Oh, favorite beers.
Like we were having Hop House yesterday, I think.
Oh, no, we had Canton Hells.
What was it we had that we hadn't had in like 10 years?
Random Copperberg just like popped up. I was just like, what is this sign they're doing up. Here? Like, okay, well,
like Pokemon.
The best beers of all time.
Yes.
Moore Brewery, that are based down in Cardiff. Very, very good.
Are we taking beers to mean a collection of any alcohols or specifically beers?
You know what we should be doing, Scott? On, we should be saying our own beer because we actually worked with and did a collaboration with Top Rope Brewery to produce the What Culture Clickbait Thumb Ale.
Yeah. That was, I haven't tasted that yet. I've got a can of that in my fridge. I've got a taster set. But
it
I
got
had
signed by Bray Wyatt. Somebody took it to a thing and found it. So the Fiend has signed a can of our beer.
Yeah, we're getting into the old beer, lager, ale market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Okay. For mine, I'm gonna admit something on this podcast. I don't think I know the difference between beer and lager. I don't know if that's, is that a thing?
There is a difference.
Okay.
But I wouldn't be able to tell you the difference.
It's like latte and cappuccino.
I don't drink either beer or lager if I can help it. I'm all about sort of like, get me the pale ales, man. That's where I'm at.
Right.
Any session IPAs, anything a bit crafty, a bit hipstery, drop it my way, man. That's what I want.
I think my color palette or taste palette is not as refined when it comes to ale stuff, because all ales just taste the same to me. Like, although I do like that, what's that milky orangey one that you've had? A blue moon.
Yeah,
I quite like Blue Moon.
Slice of orange in the top.
Yeah, cheeky slice of orange. I think that's quite nice. But I would just go just any lager, to be honest. I just go down the Estrella route. I absolutely love Estrella. And then there was something that we had last night that was nice. Basically, I don't know. I'd clearly be more specific. But
there was, we had the Camden Hells, which is always a nice solid beer. But I think that if I'm going into a pub and I'm looking for what I want to drink first, bizarrely enough, for me, it's a Guinness. I always start with a Guinness just because I absolutely love the taste. It's packed full of iron and vitamins.
It's like
and
a also sandwich in a drink.
It's like everyone always thinks that it is like a meat pie liquidized. Like it's really, really unhealthy. But it's actually like a bit of a misinformation smear campaign, because you actually take a look at it. It's got less than the next sort of like other beer, lager, ale, whatever. Mm. And it's actually the drink of choice for power lifters because of the fact it's got the low sort of like calorie content in and also is still quite strong. So I don't know who's started this thing that it is literally like eating your Sunday lunch through a straw, but it's not as unhealthy as you think it is.
Just bread in a blender. I think the thing is, like, when I was younger, my first legal pint was Guinness Extra Cold. And so I'd never had Guinness before. And we went to this like pool hall and I got a lovely like frosty pint of Guinness. And it was horrible, Jules. It was absolutely horrible. I was like, this is like, it is like drinking bread. And I just avoided it for years. And then we eventually went to Ireland and I went to the Guinness factory and
got to have the proper one.
Incredible. Yeah. Like night and day. And if you want to get proper Guinness, go to Ireland.
I tell you what, Scott, you've got a question from me now, which is, what's the worst pint you've ever had? Can you remember like a terrible drink? Because I've got two and both of them, actually, no, one didn't happen. One happened in Exeter like decades ago. And the other one was when we were out in Newcastle and it was Heppel's birthday. And we went there and I can't remember what the place was called, but it wasn't a reflection on their beer. It was just a bad time. And they had like a special on, which was called the Raining Sky or Starry Night or something like that. It's like a special one-off batch they did. And it was a sour, but it was like the worst beer I've ever had. Like it was like sour scrumpy, but it was labeled as a beer. So it was super acidic, super, super like citrusy, but was flat as well. And I was just like, this is disgusting. And
when you asked that question,
they served it with a pickle shot at the end, like a shot of pickle juice. And I was like, this plus this is the worst thing. Burning Skies. That was called Burning Skies. I tell you what, my ass was burning after it. I was just like, oh, I hated it. I hated that.
Like get a Roman candle. I think, I mean, when you said pints of stuff, my mind went to horrible banter student times of what did I make a pint of? I've had a pint of whiskey and wine that finished me off. That was horrendous.
That's disgusting.
It is a bit. And then me and you did that thing. It was me, you and Josh, when we did the challenge thing where I'd have a pint of whatever you put in.
Egg,
it was like
brine.
Egg brine and sours. And an egg or something. It was,
the egg on top.
So we've done them. I think that's still on YouTube. But that would be my worst pint when you say that. My mind immediately goes to the whiskey and wine thing because I never recovered from that.
That's awful.
That was just to finish the stuff off that was in the house before we left.
There's that song, isn't it? Where it's like drinking whiskey and wine. Da, 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 da.
Oh yeah,
da, da. I can't remember what it is.
I know what you mean. But
were you just there like, oh yeah, I'm gonna drink whiskey and wine together?
It was full on. There's a half a bottle of wine left, and there's a bottle of Jack Daniels, and let's just put them into a pint.
I'm getting a hangover just thinking about it, man.
It was horrible. I don't remember the rest of the night. Apparently, I was horrible. There are photos of me just being carried around town. I was that guy.
Bless you, mate.
In like a T shape. But then at one point, they ordered the taxi for me, and then I was waiting, and the taxi pulled up, and I immediately felt fine. I remember just like sort of standing back up,
just sobering up,
just sort of like the demons had been exercised. I was like, I'm all right, guys. No, I'm fine. And then we just carried on with the night. And so,
amazing. Yeah,
that's the one. But there's a bit in the middle that I don't remember anything for. Anyway, yes, all those beers, whatever that conversation was. Next question is from Daniel Dies at the End, who says, getting fed up of Sony messing around and I'm considering buying an Xbox Series S with Game Pass. Having had a PS1, PS2, PS3, Vita and PS4 already, is Game Pass worth the hype or does it just look good from the outside? I think it's pretty good.
Okay, so Game Pass is definitely worth the hype in the sense that I'm playing on PC and I can have access to so many great titles that were Xbox exclusive on the consoles. Like I was telling Scott, I played through all of the exclusives like Sunset Overdrive and stuff like that. So I was loving life for that. However, there have been a fair few issues with connectivity, like trying to get people all onto the same thing. Like we had a lot of issues with people who had bought their version of Halo Infinite, for example, versus those that were using it on Game Pass. Yes. Like trying to get parties set up was really difficult. Games like Back for Blood just did not work and they just were ignoring it. Like the one thing about Game Pass that is the worst is that there just doesn't seem to be any sort of technical support that's readily available. You've got the user rating system and everyone is highlighting the same problem all the way down and no fix is coming out for it.
That's a really, really good point because you do, I don't even think of it that way. I don't, which is to the problem. Like, you know, they, you do have different user cases and different almost tiers of this thing. And when those different users interact with each other, you do have different bugs like and different accessibility problems just to get a game launched between people. My thing with Game Pass is it's kind of just become like part of the furniture in a good way. It's something I like looking at. It's it's good. You have a very steady stream of games coming in. I think it's the best value for money in gaming, hands down. That's why I would recommend it. I don't feel like, I mean, the hype is there in terms of you'll fire it up and be like, oh my God, I have access to all this stuff.
That can be a problem though, can't it? Because it's like, as we were saying before, if you've got a huge library of just titles that you think to yourself, oh, I'm just going to play all of them all at once and you download all of them, you are basically committing yourself to an issue because you are not going to be able to get through all of these games.
No.
You're not going to be able to play like the top 15 brand new games as they come out. Like I've just logged on now, right? And Bugsnax has just been added to it. Now I want to download that. Through it. But at the moment, I've already got on my list. I'm playing through Death's Door. I've got Dodgeball Academia to finally polish off. I've got One Step from Eden. I've got the Streets of Rage 4. I've got all of the Warhammer, Total Warhammer 3 that's come out. I've got Dishonored, Dead Cells. Like, I'm not going to get through all of these games. I've actively had to start going through and asking myself the difficult question, am I going to finish this game within the next 6 months? If yes, if I truly believe, then it stays on the list. If not, it's in the bin. I remove it. I can't do it. And I'm not going to look at it until I can go through. So my aim is 6 months, six titles. You know what I mean?
Okay, okay. Like, that works.
And then get rid of them. I like rotate them out, but never have any more than six titles installed on my PC. It's really difficult. It's so difficult to do.
That's really, I mean, if you can regiment that, that's a really good way to actually get through the to play list. Like every, you know, self-identifying gamer has a to play list that just keeps getting added to.
And my advice, if you do want to try and commit to this lifestyle of trying to get through the games and actually keeping to it, don't have any other hobbies, don't have any pets, don't be single, like don't have anything else going on in your life, because Game Pass is one of those things where it slaps you about the face with its meaty goodness and then it just says have a chow on that and you go, I'm full. I literally, my life is full at the moment. I can only have a wafer thin piece of charcuterie, please. And it goes, nah, have some of that.
Here's another full three course meal that we've already prepared for you, and it's coming next week, it's coming next month, it'll be here forever.
It bashes you with the boof, you know what I mean?
It does. And that's the thing. That's the best thing about it. But also, you're very, very right that you just have an overwhelming amount of games. I mean, last month, or maybe the month before, it was Tunic and Shredders. And Shredders is like a really cool skate-style snowboarding game. And Tunic's a gorgeous game. Like, that'll be one of the games of the year. And it's just one of those things where you end up playing everything in tandem and then nothing gets finished. And I view it like Bart Simpson when he writes, he gets that, it's like a seven-strand chalk thing. And he starts writing all the sentences all at once. And until they'll all get finished eventually, but like until they're there, nothing's actually finished. And so Game Pass, it's phenomenal value for money, and it is the best deal in gaming. I think
super easy to be overwhelmed by, isn't it? You've seen Back to the Future Part 2, haven't you?
Yes.
You know, like the bit where he like switches on the TV and he's got like 14 channels all at once. Like, you can't pay attention to all of them. That's what Game Pass is like, mate.
Kinda, yeah. And I think if Daniel's saying that he's already had all the Sony side of things, then, and if you know in your gut that you're not bothered about revisiting Tekken 3 or whatever, then like dive into the Xbox side of stuff. Next question from Christopher Snow, who says, as someone who's been going back through Arkham Asylum, Bioshock and Sleeping Dogs, I understand Scott's position with wanting to play older games. Do you think that comes from not having online features and not having to wait 10 minutes to play the good old days?
I mean, they're just very strong single player experiences though, that you've just described there, like the Batman Arkham games, like even including Origins, I'd say are very, very strong titles. Like you play through them and you never feel like you're being beset with all of the the trappings of a modern era of gaming.
Yeah, you're not
like
struggling
the microtransactions, or there's like there's no thing telling you you must play online to do this bit. It's just you get to enjoy it at your own pace. You get to chase achievements you want to chase, and not because of the fact that the game is telling you that if you do, you'll unlock the one actual hidden feature of the game or whatever. Like,
plus, all three of these are like cinematically fueled games. You really care about what's going on, whether you care about the character side of it or you really care about the thematics and the narrative. Like, yeah, and like Jules said, they're really good meaty single player games, which are barely a thing anymore. Like, it's you hardly ever get them. Like, nearly everything is multiplayer instead.
I was thinking about this. What if games that we liked from back in the day, maybe 10, 15 years ago, were released today? And I'm not talking like a remastered version. I'm talking about it's the exact same thing and never been done before until that point. And I realized how much I would hate BioShock if it came out in this day and age.
Really?
Because I reckon that if a developer got their hand, or a publisher, I should say, got their hands on it, it would have a multiplayer focus, because it would have to have something to keep people
like BioShock 2.
It would have like a daily grind thing where it would be maybe Rapture would be open world and you'd have to log in every single day and do certain grindy bits in order to get like that. The perks would be restricted to pre-order bonuses, or you'd be able to download new ones to patch in, like to plug into that one. There would be no single player DLC, because why would they want to waste time with that? And I'm pretty sure there would be like really ridiculous tie-ins just to sell it. So it'd be like, get your free code with Sonic Burger if you for BioShock, which will give you unlimited bees.
Like, I think, I mean, the thing is, like, you would hope that someone like Ken Levine, this thing is, there's like auteurs ruled the roost back then. Like, Ken, like, BioShock exists in the way that it does because Ken Levine is like monstrously efficient. He wouldn't yield at all.
But remember, he had to yield immediately because remember, he wanted this to be a System Shock 3, effectively. Like, that was his idea with it. And Microsoft, or whoever like had his ear at the time, said, you need to have shooting elements in this game. Otherwise, it's not going to sell. And let's be honest with ourselves here. The shooting in the original BioShock is, I'd say, one of the weaker components of it. It feels like it is a functionary thing. It is completely competent, but it is nothing more
than that. I said I would prefer BioShock if it was a walking simulator. If it was Gone Home style, I would have loved it.
The horror and tension would be so like taut, because you'd be walking around thinking, oh man, any given moment something could come out and attack me, and I will have no way to defend myself. As it stands, by the end of the game, when the splicers are like crawling over the walls and stuff, you're like, yeah, admittedly it is freaky, but when I can zap you with the power of a god and then shoot you as before you land and you're dead, like, it does take a little bit of the sort of like, ooh, I'm scared.
If they ever, because we got BioShock 4 coming up, like, if they sort of like add more weight to the movement and let you chain stuff together a bit better, then I guess like that side of it would finally feel up there. But it's like, BioShock is never recommended for a shooting. Like, it's just not the thing people talk about,
which is why I really do not understand why people say that Infinite is their favorite one. Like, like, just because you don't understand a story doesn't mean it's deep. No offense to the people out there, like, it's actually like an incredibly it's convoluted, but that doesn't mean it's a great story.
Well, I mean, it went through development hell. Like, they did their best they could. They did the best they could, but it's not pristinely rolled out or anything.
Is it Crobat?
Yes.
Like, who did the this is the BioShock you should have got, and we saw all of the like the alpha footage and all of the trailers that were pre-release trailers and stuff, and I was like, I wish that we got that game, because it wasn't all about the shooting and the action. It was about world building and the setting of Columbia being this really like broken down and on the precipice of its own destruction. Whereas what we got in that game was, well, we got health bars above enemies. We got bullet sponge tanky things.
The handyman doesn't make any sense. Like, fighting, it's horrible. The skyhooks didn't really do anything.
It literally just goes from A to B. Like, there's so much about that game that I sat through and I played through, and I was like, yeah, okay, I'm having a good time, but I'm also not having a good BioShock time. And
I hope they tweak those things in the new one, because it's weird because they don't have Levine, so they don't have like the narrative pull, the sort of weighty side of it. It's like, what, that team's kind of hampered from the beginning anyway.
But this is where we go back to sort of like looking at what GTA 6 is going to be putting up with.
Yes.
They look at what is working now and think that that is what GTA 6 or the future of GTA has got to be. They look at BioShock and what do they see? They see the plasmids, or the sort of like vigors. We've got the skyhook style thing for traversal, so they'll probably put that sort of element of traversal mechanics in there. And of course, a ton of shooting. So it's basically the things that BioShock never set out to be are going to be championed as its biggest features, which is going to be incredibly weird. Now, I'm not trying to poo-poo on a series and a franchise that I utterly adore. But at the same time, nothing gets me more worried than when a pseudo horror game says the action is front and center. Mm-hmm. Happened with Resident Evil 6, happened with Dead Space 3. It's definitely going to happen to Bioshock anything, if they don't play it safe.
Yeah, anything where a corporate think tank takes over from an auteur is nearly always goes sideways. As you know, see infinite examples, Avengers to Anthem and everything else. A final question from Luis Ligori, who says, gentlemen, hope you're good. Just one Sonic question. How is Shadow the Hedgehog? How is Shadow the Hedgehog in 2022? As a kid, I loved it. You could be evil. You had guns. You rode bikes. You fought Sonic. Then in college, the game came up and everyone said it sucked. I went home and looked at the reviews and turns out my life was a lie.
Oh, man. It's like he is the ultimate edgelord. He is like everything that I think of when I think of just worrisome. Like,
see, the thing is, the age that we are, I don't care about Shadow. I thought he was cringy as hell. To be honest, I dropped right off the Sonic everything across the 2000. Yeah. I'm only back in now because the movie's out. And but funnily enough, when you talk to the younger people in our office, the James Dowses, the Josh Browns, they have a huge love for Shadow the Hedgehog. And I think it's because when that game came out, it was the full-on Tude of the mid-2000s where everyone was twin pistols and slow-motion dives and everything else. And I guess if you were watching The Matrix, then maybe you went from that to Shadow and it just worked.
Listen, man, it would be hypocritical of us to sit here and say that we don't also have 6 out of 10 games that we champion as being the best ever. Like, it's literally what we've been doing for this entire podcast. The amount of times that we bring up PsyOps, the Mindgate conspiracy, as the perfect example of a 6 out of 10.
That is an 8, my friend.
That is an 8 in our minds. Like, Shadow the Hedgehog is a straight 6 out of 10 game. Mm-hmm. Like, it's got mediocre writing, the gameplay is wonky as hell, the character just laughable to people outside of the thing, and even like more cringy sometimes if you're a deep fan and you're just like, oh god, I gotta put up with this. Mm-hmm. But I can understand that being a kid, like in my teens, playing that, I probably would be like, that's pretty cool.
Well, the thing is, like, I've said so much, and I swear to everyone listening to me, I'm out of the Sonic bubble. I'm leaving it. Poisoned. I was under for like 2.5 weeks. I've played every single game, and now I've just run out of stuff to play. But I've never played Shadow the Hedgehog, so I don't know if I should find some way to get access to that. I think it
would be a very good learning experience for you to at least experience it once. So maybe we should do it for like a charity event where you play through Shadow the Hedgehog.
We could play the worst Sonic games: Shadow the Hedgehog, Sonic 2006. And then Sonic Fighters or something, like something that's absolutely atrocious.
Sonic Racing, Sonic R was pretty bad. Rise of Lyric is bad. Sonic Boom.
Oh, the Sonic Boom game. Yeah.
I mean, we've just populated 5 already, pretty much. Like, there's that one where he became a knight of Arthurian legend.
Sonic and the Black Knight. Yeah.
That was pretty bad.
I think, funnily enough, I was reading an article the other day that had mentioned that, and I was like, I didn't even know that game existed, but it was on the Wii. And I was like, Sonic in like fantasy garb with like a gauntlet and a big blade. I was like, that's kind of cool in my twisted, toxic state.
But that was just when he was just like, he was every man. He was just trying everything possible. Like, the Sonic for Hire anime TV show became a real reality for him, as he just basically genre switched all the thing. It was a YouTube animated show.
Oh, I know
show.
What you mean. If they,
you know
if
the
they,
one I'm talking about?
Yeah. I think if they did something that acknowledged just how many costumes he's had or how many different roles he's had, that's brilliant. Because the Sonic Boom show is entirely self-aware as well, especially when it comes to the fandom and everything. That was the final Sonic question. Okay. There are no more Sonic questions. I'm healthy now. Just because 2 Sonic mugs just arrived at my door and I've got a Knuckles t-shirt, don't you let me be telling you that there's more of this to come. Point being, this has been the Untitled Panda Podcast. I've been your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Jules Gill.
Thank you very much for having me.
Humongous thank you to all of you for sending in all your questions. I'm over at blah, blah, blah. I'm over on Twitter at /LP89. Mr. Jules, what are you?
I am over on Twitter at RetroJ, but the O is a 0, and we will be putting out our questions next Thursday. So stay tuned on either account and you can submit your questions. We will try and answer at least, as I've said before, between 2 and 3 of them.
More than 2. We can guarantee more than 2. Beautifully done. Thank you all very much once again, and we'll catch you next week.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan,
turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.